My name's Harry. I'm a former cop and currently a private investigator. I've been based in London for the past 14 years. I won't get into the ins and outs of why I left the force because I could write a whole book on how I feel about the Metropolitan Police, but let's just say that I felt a bit underappreciated. And in 2010, I hung up my Bobby's hat for good to make a lot more money for myself in the private sector. I worked for a couple of different firms during those first few years, mostly doing things like background checks, investigating insurance fraud, or doing asset searches for the likes of divorce lawyers. It was good money, but some of it was so boring that it actually made me miss working for the Met sometimes. Infidelity investigation was more my thing, but with it being a very sad and very dirty game, there was only so much of it that I could stomach before I was looking for other kinds of jobs. Corporate investigations paid well, rooting out embezzlement and things of that nature, but the thing that I really enjoyed doing was finding missing people. When an old colleague recommended it, I didn't think that it'd be a big enough earner. If a person goes missing and it's urgent, people go to the police, not a PI. But as it turned out, and for a variety of different reasons, not everyone wants the police involved. I think the best and most rewarding example of this would be the woman who hired me to find her sister, who'd unfortunately become involved in street prostitution to pay off a drug debt. Being able to get a vulnerable person off the street and reunite them with their family was more rewarding than any paycheck. Money is nice, but if you can't look yourself in the mirror in the mornings, it's not worth the paper it's printed on, is it? And so, that's what I stuck to. If there weren't any missing person jobs, I'd work the corporate side of things, which felt like actual detective work. But for the most part, I worked the former, and the more I did so, the more I built a reputation for myself as being one of the best on the market. And that is how I ended up getting a call from Mr. and Mrs. Pennington. They'd said that I'd been recommended by someone they knew, a guy who used to run a housing scheme for vulnerable young people. I knew exactly who they were talking about as I chatted with him about work stuff a few times before. I asked if they were free for a face-to-face, as I always insist on an in-person meeting before committing to any job. They said that they were free that afternoon, so a few hours after getting the call, I was sitting in their front room with a cup of tea and a biscuit, hearing all about their missing grandson, Jamie. They were a lovely old couple in their late 60s named Connell and Maureen, and they hadn't spoken to Jamie in just over a month. They'd been his legal guardian since the death of his parents when he was still just a boy, and they'd always been very close. But then a few months after he moved out for the first time and into his first ever flat in Fitzrovia, he'd suddenly stopped answering his phone. And that wasn't like him at all, and they were scared something might have happened to him. In terms of resources, they had pictures of him, the address of the coffee shop that he'd been employed at until only recently, along with a few other tidbits that might help with finding him, which included the reason they didn't want to talk to the police, not unless it was absolutely necessary. You see, 19-year-old Jamie had always known about the untimely death of his parents, but he'd remained blissfully ignorant of the gorier details. Well, around the time of his 19th birthday, Jamie decides that he wants to know the whole truth surrounding his parents' passing. Granddad sits him down over a couple of cans of lager and tells him all about the hit and run they'd suffered, and the driver who'd left them for dead. If he'd stuck around and called an ambulance, maybe they'd still be alive. But since the cowardly bastard didn't fancy the jail time, he scarpered off without bothering to call 999. Someone saw them later, lying there in the road, all broken and bloodied and gasping for air, then they rushed to phone an ambulance. But it was too late. And sometime between the call and the ambulance's arrival, Jamie's parents passed away at the roadside. The deaths he could handle, but the hit and run was another kettle of fish altogether. Connell and Maureen said he seemed a bit down for the weeks that followed, and didn't seem himself when he came to visit. They thought that he might be on drugs, in which case they didn't want the police arresting him for possession should he be carrying any when they found him, and they said that they'd never be able to live with themselves if he went to prison off the back of their missing persons report, and I was inclined to agree with them. The likelihood of him getting a custodial sentence for a first-time drug offense was slim, But earning himself a criminal record would definitely affect his employment prospects, not to mention his chances of securing a place at university. My services wouldn't come cheap, but having me find him before the police did might save Jamie a hell of a lot of trouble in the future. So I took a deposit, thanked them for the cup of tea and the biscuit, and then promised Connell and Maureen that I'd find their grandson. My first stop was the coffee shop Jamie was working at before he disappeared. I drove over to Fitzrovia, found the cafe, and then asked one of the girls behind the counter if she knew him. She didn't, but she quickly found someone who did, and in exchange for buying something, she agreed to sit down and have a chat with me. Jamie's grandparents had made him out to be quite the innocent young thing, one who might have gotten himself in trouble thanks to his unfamiliarity with drink, drugs, and the London nightlife. But according to the nice girl in the coffee shop, that was not the Jamie she knew. Firstly, I was under the impression that Jamie had only stopped going to work at the coffee shop because he'd disappeared, but that wasn't the case. He'd actually handed in his notice, under perfectly normal circumstances, about 2 months prior, apparently after having gotten another job elsewhere. But the location of that employment, along with descriptions of his behavior, painted a very different picture of young Jamie. Apparently, Jamie was quite the party animal, and was far from the naive teenage boy his grandparents had made him out to be. And that's par for the course, I suppose. A couple of sweet older people like that aren't likely to tell you that their grandchild is a bad kid, and that's assuming they knew what he was up to in the first place. And by the sounds of it, he was up to quite a bit. His ex-colleague told me that there was rarely a night that he wasn't drinking, dancing, or otherwise getting himself into wild adventures. I was told that he had a heart of gold. When it came to his lifestyle, he was quite the libertine, and far from the angel I'd first thought him to be. And that brings me to his choice of employment following the coffee shop. On more than one occasion, Jamie had turned up to do a morning shift at the coffee shop after dancing and taking drugs all night. He'd apparently pulled it off with style, but when he started living a full-on nocturnal lifestyle, it was clearly time to consider alternative employment. And so off he went, to work in a nightclub. His former colleague said that the place had been a regular haunt of his, one of those quote-unquote secret underground bars that's only known by its Soho street address. To her, it sounded like he was there so often he was practically a piece of furniture, and in the end, one of the managers offered him a trial shift. Shaking cocktails and chatting up punters sounded a lot more his speed, so it was bittersweet to hear that he was leaving. But after some leaving drinks at a local pub, she wished him luck, and off he went to turn his party lifestyle into a profession. The girl at the coffee shop was only too happy to help me after hearing about him going missing, and after wishing me luck in finding him, she gave me the name of the bar Jamie had been working at. And then off I drove to Soho to talk to the people at that bar. The place didn't open up until 9 at night, so I went home for a few hours before driving back. I then had to try and talk my way past the bouncer, who wouldn't let me in without paying the exorbitant 20 quid non-member's entrance fee. And he eventually relents and radios for one of the supervisors to come out and have a chat with me. But she takes one look at one of the pictures of Jamie I had on my phone and tells me that she's never seen him before in her entire life. She was quite prickly with how she said it, too. And then before I could ask anything else, she walked straight back inside without saying another word to me. But she didn't need to, because I knew she was lying. When you show somebody a picture of someone, and they've truly never seen them before, they actually look and think for a good couple of seconds before giving you a definitive answer. If they do recognize the person, they always answer much faster, and generally speaking, they exhibit a tell, be it raised eyebrows or a softening of their features, which lets you know that there's been that recognition. This supervisor girl ticked both boxes. Fast answer, and there was the instant softening of the facial features when she looked at that picture. It was clear to me that she knew Jamie. So then, why was she trying to hide it? I ended up paying the 20 entrance fee just to get a feel for the place Jamie had apparently spent so much time in. I spent about half an hour at the bar, sipping at a bottle of some fancy overpriced beer, and asking various people who approached the bar if they knew this guy called Jamie. Some knew him, and were open about this, whereas others gave me the same cold shoulder as the supervisor did, who spent the whole time giving me dirty looks from behind the bar. and I knew it was only a matter of time before she got the doorman to ask me to leave, so while I still could, I asked one of the barmaids if I could talk to her manager. But as soon as he walked into the bar, the supervisor intercepted him. And I couldn't exactly hear what she said because of the volume of the music, but I could tell that she was spinning some line about me harassing customers or whatever she was complaining about. And by the time he got to me, I thought the manager was just going to ask me to leave. But instead, he started asking me for credentials to prove that I was a PI. The only thing I ever carry are my business cards, but they're nice and expensive looking and always do the trick. So all I had to do was show him one of them, and he invited me into his office for a little chat. It turns out I was right about the supervisor. She knew Jamie, everyone behind the bar did, and he was easily their favorite customer too. That's why she was so protective in claiming not to know him, and regarding that protectiveness, that was something I needed to know. The last time they'd talked to Jamie, so a couple of weeks prior, he hadn't seemed himself. Usually he was well up for the party, lit up the room when he arrived, and was all hugs and kisses with anyone he knew personally. But on this occasion, he sat by the bar, not really socializing, and told one of the barmaids that he was waiting for someone. A very anxious-looking Jamie also told the barmaid that he was hoping to straighten something out with the person he was waiting for. But then after fiddling with his phone for a few minutes, most likely swapping texts with someone, Jamie told the barmaid that he might not see them for a while, and then off he went. The bar's manager also went to tell me that half the reason the supervisor had been so defensive was that just a few days prior, a guy had come in looking for Jamie. When the super asked who the man was, she'd never seen him at the bar before, he got very defensive and started demanding to know where Jamie was. He only left after two bouncers came downstairs to walk him out, and the manager said that his supervisor thought I was another one of those guys looking for poor, defenseless Jamie. They were all worried about him, and they were going to be devastated when they heard that he hadn't been checking in with his grandparents. I also offered to put the manager in touch with Connell and Maureen, just to give some peace of mind that I had their grandson's best interests at heart. He declined, but appreciated the offer and said it did indeed do a lot to reassure him, and he also added that if he had to make a guess, he'd suggest Camden, where an old regular customer slash boyfriend of Jamie's lived. And that's how I found out Jamie was involved in prostitution. The job that had more suited his lifestyle wasn't behind the bar of that trendy underground place in Soho, or at least not behind the bar anyway. The employment that had been getting him a load more cash than that coffee shop and that allowed him to mostly work at night was sex work. As you can imagine, this complicated the situation a great deal. For the most part, people who sell their bodies often put themselves in potentially dangerous situations on a near nightly basis, and they also tend to deal with some very shady people. Jamie could have pissed off the wrong client, ended up in debt with a pimp or a dealer, or simply gone home with someone who took their little games too far, maybe even fatally far. The absolute best I could hope for was that Jamie really had gone to shack up with this older customer or partner, whoever he turned out to be, and was keeping himself out of trouble. It also meant that I could focus my search around Camden, which wasn't quite the needle in a haystack situation I thought that it might be. I spent about 3 days trotting around Camden, sitting in cafes, stopping into pubs, and keeping Jamie's grandparents updated all the while. I didn't tell them all the stuff about his nightly activities or his newfound method of making money, but I did confirm their suspicion that he'd taken his party lifestyle a bit too far. That was the bad news, but when it came to the good news, there was plenty to be happy about. One of Jamie's closest friends, the manager of that bar that he'd been a regular at, had given me my biggest and most reliable clue yet to his whereabouts. I was close, and I could feel it, and they were happy to hear it. On that third day of hanging around Camden, keeping my eyes peeled and stopping at the occasional pub to ask the smokers outside if they recognized Jamie, I saw him. I was sitting in some coffee shop wondering if I was just wasting my time going around Camden instead of following other leads, when a young man walked into the coffee shop to collect an order for pickup. He didn't use the name Jamie, he said Sean. And I didn't twig that it was him until I looked up and recognized a flash of bleached blonde hair under the baseball cap he was wearing. He had sunglasses on too, but they weren't big or garish enough to distract me from the facial features that I've been looking at for almost a week by this point. The second he left the coffee shop, I started following him, keeping my distance but tailing him all the same. We walked all the way down Camden High Street and then turned onto Pratt Street in the direction of St. Martin's Gardens. I kept my distance as I watched him walk down the path of a large three-story house. Then when he knocked on the door, it was answered by an older man he swapped kisses with before being welcomed inside. And that was Jamie's older lover. It had to be. So as far as I was concerned, I'd found him. Mission accomplished, I thought. It was late in the afternoon, so I called Jamie's grandparents to let them know that I'd found their grandson. I then asked if they wanted me to approach him or simply keep track of him so they could make their move whenever they were ready. I recommended they do it soon because it seemed like he was in trouble with someone, and there was a chance that he might move on somewhere else if he thought he was being followed. We talked on speakerphone so I could hear Connell and Maureen weighing up their options before they decided what they were going to do. In the end, they asked me to keep tabs on Jamie for just one more day, and that they'd have a definite answer by tomorrow. Now, I wasn't about to say no. Extra hours meant extra pay, so I parked a few houses down and then stayed up all night making sure that Jamie didn't go anywhere. The next morning, I got a coffee and some breakfast delivered to my car and was confident that no one had entered or exited the house Jamie was in. I stayed there until early afternoon, at which point I decided to give Maureen and Connell another call to see if they'd made their minds up yet. But no sooner had I pressed dial than I heard, "The number you have dialed is not currently available. Please hang up and try again." I thought Connell's phone was out of battery or something, so I gave it about 10 to 15 minutes then called back, only to get the same automated message. I started to get a bit worried because it wouldn't be the first time some scumbag had targeted a person's family as a way of getting to them personally, so I drove over to Maureen and Connell's house to make sure that they were all right. I parked outside, walked up the path, but when I knocked on the door, neither Maureen nor Connell answered. Instead, it was a woman that I'd never seen before, who at first didn't seem to recognize their names. It was only after I explained who I was and that I'd visited not a week prior that she seemed to remember who I was talking about. She then explained that she was house-sitting for them while they were on holiday. I remember asking, "They've gone on holiday?" in total disbelief, because I'd spoken to them only just the previous evening. The woman then explained she didn't know what I was talking about, and that she was just the house-sitter, and how she was sorry that she couldn't be of more help. I felt so confused it was like feeling a migraine coming on, and I had to double-check everything to make sure that I hadn't totally misheard her. Connell and Maureen were the homeowners, yes, but they'd gone on holiday that very same morning, apparently after having arranged it months prior. I told her there must have been some mistake, that they couldn't have gone on holiday. And at that, the woman started to get visibly agitated. She told me there was no mistake and that she couldn't help me, and that I should try calling Connell and Maureen again once they'd landed. The dead phones were probably because they were on the plane and switched them off. I walked away more confused than when I arrived, and after trying his mobile a few more times, Connell still hadn't switched it back on. My mind was ticking over big time, wondering why a man would switch his phone off and go on holiday when he's just paid a lot of money to have me find his grandson. And the more I thought about it, the more I got this horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. I spent the next hour or so weighing up my options so I could take the best possible course of action for all involved. And in the end, I settled on warning young Jamie that his grandparents might be in trouble. I drove back into Camden, parked up by that St. Martin's Gardens, and then walked down the path of the house that I'd seen Jamie walk into. I rang the doorbell first, and it sounded a little bit too loud. But the door wasn't all the way closed, so I gave it a knock, only to find it creaked open a bit under the force. My bad feeling was absolutely peaking by then. I had been on the job long enough to know something was very, very wrong if a front door hadn't been shut properly, and there was no reply from anyone inside when I started calling out for somebody. I started to search the house, going from room to room until I eventually got to the master bedroom on the second floor. I pushed open the door, and there they were. Jamie, along with his older customer-turned-boyfriend, were lying on the bed, and from the looks of things, they'd been butchered. There was blood everywhere, so much of it that I knew that there was no chance either was alive. But I could also tell from the way they looked that they'd only been dead for maybe a matter of hours. Of course, I called the police, waited at the scene for them to arrive, and then told my story twice in detail. First to a uniformed officer, and then to an officer from CID once it had been established that two murders had taken place. I didn't need to be fingerprinted or anything because as a former Met officer, my fingerprints are on file. But I did have to give an extensive interview describing exactly how I came to be involved in the case to begin with. Then the more I talked it out with detectives in the weeks and months that followed, the more I started to realize what had actually been happening. Connell and Maureen weren't just really Jamie's grandparents, and they probably weren't even named Connell and Maureen either. The woman's whose house they used in their ruse told us they'd turned up one day and gave her an offer she couldn't refuse. Clear out the house for a few days and hand over the keys, or they'd burn it down with her in it. They gave her some money as a reward, or more like something to make sure she stuck to the story they'd given her. But when the police got involved, she was so scared that she handed over the money right away. £10,000, untouched and still wrapped in plastic in a shoebox. They'd completely pulled the wool over my eyes, and in doing so, they conned me into tracking down a person they wanted dead. And these murders went unsolved. It wasn't clear if all the butchery meant that it was a personal thing, or if a professional had dressed the scene up to look like it was a personal thing in order to confuse the police. It looked like someone had savagely attacked Jamie and his lover while they slept, but there was also no sign of forced entry and no evidence of anyone else having been in the house save for the stab wounds on their body. Whoever had done it might have done so right under my nose as I was watching the house that night, or they'd waited until I was no longer on the scene before slipping in through the front door with a lockpick or a copy of the key. And aside from the obvious details, the whole thing was a total mystery. Forensics even checked over that house that I'd first met them in for any DNA or hair indication of who Maureen or Connell might be. But they'd had the place completely scrubbed before allowing the woman to return home, and with the owner herself saying it smelled like a hospital for days afterwards. The identity of Jamie's lover also remained a mystery, or at least outside of a select few it did. He'd been a well-to-do barrister, someone with a lot of money and someone whose family wanted to keep his name out of the papers once it had emerged who he'd been cheating on his wife with. They filed all kinds of injunctions with the high courts so that, when all was said and done, Jamie's murder was relegated to just a few column inches that was never followed up on. In the past, I've spoken to private investigators who've talked about having that one case that always sticks with you, and for a long time I wondered which case would end up being mine. But after Jamie, I don't wonder anymore. He is that case, and he'll always be with me until the day I die. So I was a cop for 15 years, mostly working financial crimes. I transferred from homicide to the grand larceny division quite early on and quickly discovered that the thing I enjoyed most was how numbers really can't lie. It almost didn't matter what suspects had to say during the interview portion of an investigation because I knew that just one look through their accounts would tell me the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help them God. I got pretty damn good at my job, too, so much so that when I retired, I decided to try my hand as a private detective. My office wasn't much, and I didn't have the resources I did back on the force, but working on my own suited me just fine. I got to pick my own cases for once, stuff that really caught my attention, which included the one that I'm about to tell you. One day, a lawyer that I'd known from my police days gave my office a call, saying that he had an important client who'd required my services. It turned out a certain massive multinational company thought someone was messing with their cash flow, which ran like a river through almost every major country on the planet. Given my background, the lawyer figured that I was the right man for the job, and considering the pay they were offering, I didn't disagree. The company had accounts scattered across the globe, and the paperwork was a maze of transfers, receipts, and invoices. Piecing it all together proved to be one hell of a task, but I'd seen worse in my time on the force. I started poring over spreadsheets and bank statements, looking for anything that didn't quite fit or seemed out of place. And then after a few days of searching, I found something. I started to notice subtle inconsistencies in the international cash flow. Stuff like payments being funneled to shell companies that didn't seem to do anything, amounts that didn't match the usual patterns, and transactions which popped up at strange hours. To anyone else, what I was looking at might have seemed like nothing more than innocent clerical errors, but I knew better. Money was slipping away, and someone was making that happen. I spent the next few days cross-referencing records or tracking the flow of cash from one account to the next, and the deeper I dug, the clearer it became that the discrepancies I was seeing weren't an accident. Someone inside the company was siphoning funds, and they were pretty damn good at covering their tracks, too. Just not quite good enough to hide it from me. The numbers had given me a trail, but I needed names to go with it, so I set up interviews with key players in the company, one of which was the CFO, the guy who's paid to keep the books clean. And I met him in that sleek office of his, with its floor-to-ceiling windows and a view of the city skyline, and he greeted me with a handshake and a smile. At first I kept it light but professional, and asked a bunch of very generalized questions about the company's finances. Then once the CFO was comfortable, I started zeroing in on one payment, a large transfer to a vague overseas account that had caught my eye. I wanted to know who signed off on it, but when I asked him, he said he couldn't recall. It must have been someone in his department, but he didn't handle every detail himself. Coming from the CFO, that did not sit right with me, not one bit. People in his position don't forget who approves a 7-figure cash transfer to an overseas territory, so as you can imagine, his answer left a very sour taste in my mouth. Next on the interview schedule came some of the CFO's co-workers, people who worked closely enough with him to know his day-to-day activities. One was a mid-level manager who handled international accounts, and when I asked about that same transfer, he scratched his head and mentioned a meeting where it had been discussed. The CFO had also mentioned such a meeting but claimed that he hadn't attended, yet when I asked that mid-level manager if the CFO was present that day, he said yes. I pressed the manager for details, but he stuck to his story, saying the CFO had been present at the meeting, and unless there had been some grand miscommunication, he'd been well aware of the amount and destination of the transfer. Next, I talked to an assistant who had been with the finance team for years. She acted very nervous as she claimed not to remember any specifics, but did say that she remembered the CFO signing off on something big around that time. She said it had seemed urgent, too, and that the CFO had told the finance team to get it done fast. I now had two different stories, both clashing with the CFO's version of events. The cracks were showing, and I could feel the case was starting to heat up. After that last interview, I left the building and headed to my car, which was parked in a quiet lot about a block away. I had a small tape recorder that I used to record thoughts after meetings, an old habit that I kept from my days as a cop. So after I slid into the driver's seat, I hit record and started thinking out loud like I'd done so many times before. I laid out what I'd learned, from the suspicious gaps in the CFO's memory to the assistant's offhand comment about the rush job, and I figured that I could be onto something significant. The next step was finding out who owned that overseas account, and I figured there was a pretty good chance that sooner or later, my hunt for its owner would lead me right back to the company itself. After that, I remember saying something about how the CFO might prove to be a key player in what could prove to be a huge case of international wire fraud, but I never got to finish that thought. A sudden crack split the air, and before I could react, my driver's side window exploded inward and showered me with glass. Instinct kicked in, and I ducked down in my seat, but I didn't move fast enough. 4 shots rang out, one after the other. The first bullet tore a hole through the dashboard just above my lap. It splintered the plastic, and I felt the vibration of the impact in my thighs. The second shot grazed my left shoulder, slicing through my jacket and shirt, peeling back the skin. Blood welled up instantly, soaking my sleeve as I jerked sideways and slammed my head against the steering wheel. The third bullet punched into the passenger seat beside me, missing my ribs by a matter of inches. I felt the seat shudder as it slammed through the stuffing. My heart was like a jackhammer in my chest, and adrenaline screamed at me to flee, but There was no time to process what was going on before the fourth shot hit me square in the jaw, and everything changed. The impact was like a sledgehammer swung full force into my face, and I'll never forget the feeling of the pain suddenly exploding through my skull. The bullet entered just below my left cheekbone, shattering bone and teeth as it carved a path through my jaw. I felt the crunch of it breaking apart, fragments grinding against each other as the slug ripped through muscle and exited just below my ear. My mouth flooded with blood, but also the chalky grit of my own shattered teeth. My vision was blurred, and the world seemed to just sort of tilt on its axis as shock set in. My hands flailed, searching for something to hold on to, be it the door, the wheel, anything, but I felt my body shutting down. Darkness crept into the edges of my vision, and the last thing I remember was the faint hiss of the tape recorder still running as I slipped into unconsciousness. The next thing I remember was waking up in a hospital bed, hearing that steady beeping cutting through the haze. My entire body was aching. It hurt just to breathe, and my shoulder burned where that bullet had just grazed it. But that was nothing compared to my jaw. It felt like someone had bolted a steel vise to my face and cranked it tight, which in a sense is exactly what the doctors had done to keep my skull together. Every time I tried to speak, swallow, or move my mouth, a jolt of agony shot through me. But the worst was when I used my tongue to probe the damage, feeling empty sockets where my teeth once were and the cold feeling of the metal wires holding my shattered jaw together. I don't know exactly how long it was after I woke up, but a nurse noticed that I was awake and hurried over to me. She told me not to move, and at first, I had no memory of how I ended up in the hospital. But as soon as she started explaining that I'd been shot multiple times, all those memories flooded back. The shoulder graze was minor, she said, but the jaw wound was bad. The bullet had entered my left cheek, fractured my mandible in two places, obliterated half my lower teeth, and then exited near my ear, taking out a chunk of soft tissue with it. They'd rushed me into the ER to stop the bleeding and stabilize the bones, and the surgery had been a success. She kept saying that I was lucky to be alive, but in that moment I didn't feel very lucky. I remember the frustration I felt as I tried to ask questions, but with my jaw wired shut, the words came out as nothing but garbled nonsense. I gestured for something to write with, and the nurse handed me a notepad and pen. My hand shook as I started scrawling these things, asking what happened and who shot me. She didn't know much, just that the police were investigating and would soon visit me. I tried to nod, but even that small motion sent a flash of pain through me. Later, the surgeon came by. He was a tall man with a calm voice that somehow made me feel at ease despite everything, and after some initial questions, he pulled up a chair and laid it out for me. Treating the graze to my shoulder was pretty simple, and all they'd needed to do was clean and stitch and bandage that. But my teeth was a lost cause. The bullet had smashed them into splinters, so they extracted the roots and shards during the surgery and then suctioned them all out to prevent infection. My jaw was wired shut, this grid of metal loops keeping it immobile while the bones were fused, and he said that it'd probably be weeks, maybe months, before they could remove the wires, and even then, I'd need dental implants to replace what was gone. I was listening, but my head was going absolutely nuts from the meds and the shock, but all I could do was wonder who had shot me, and whether or not they'd try and finish the job. Two detectives arrived the next morning and stood by my bed as I wrote out everything I remembered. They read over what I'd written and then filled me in on some of the details that I was missing. Thanks to the bullet holes in the dash and the seat and the blood soaked into the upholstery, my car was officially a crime scene until it could be cleared for release. The tape recorder had caught the whole thing, the cracks of gunfire, my choking, and then the silence after I passed out, so I guess that was being held for evidence as well. And like the nurse, the detectives told me that I was lucky, not because of the circumstances of my injuries, but because the person they believed had been hired to kill me had been an amateur and not a pro. A real hitman would have made sure that I wasn't breathing before leaving the scene. The detectives also told me about the security camera footage they had from a store across the street. It showed a grainy figure, little more than the shadow of a back and an arm, as he hesitated, fumbled the shots, and then just ran off in a panic. One of the detectives said that it looked like a first-timer, someone cheap and desperate. They'd found 9mm shell casings at the scene, but no prints and therefore no clear leads. In response, I wrote down something about my suspicions regarding that company CFO, and they nodded and said they'd look into it, but I saw the skepticism. Corporate cases were always murky and convoluted, and without evidence tying the hit to someone specific, even making an arrest would be a long shot. For the next few weeks or so, the hospital became my entire world. Even with all the pills, the ambient pain was a constant companion, like a dull ache in my jaw that flared up into razor-sharp spikes every time I made the wrong move. Eating was impossible, so I was put on a liquid diet and fed through a straw. The nurses blended my meals into a gray mush consisting of things like broth, mashed veggies, and protein shakes. It tasted like wet cardboard and swallowing hurt, but I had no choice other than to force it down if I wanted to stick to my recovery schedule. My shoulder healed fast, but the stitches itched under the bandage. Infection was definitely a risk, but the nurses kept me pumped full of antibiotics to keep that at bay. Physical therapy started early, which amounted to this grueling routine aimed at stopping my jaw from locking up permanently. A therapist named Claire visited me every day. She was all smiles and patience and would sit me up, prop pillows behind me, and then guide me through exercises which stretched my muscles without cracking the healing bones. She'd ask me to open my mouth, and I'd be in so much pain that I'd start sweating as I tried. But I did try. And some days I could manage a few millimeters, and other days nothing at all. On those days, Claire would just sort of nod, completely unfazed, and jot notes while I just silently cussed myself out. I felt trapped in a body that wouldn't obey, but Claire kept the faith that I'd be able to heal, and she was eventually proven right. Sometimes it felt like the silence was worse than the pain. I'd always been something of a talker, but after that shooting, I was a mute, scribbling notes or pointing like a nonverbal child. Friends visited, bringing cards and awkward energy, but I couldn't join in, and I wouldn't be in the mood to celebrate my survival for quite a bit of time after that. My sister stopped by too, just sitting quietly with tears in her eyes as she watched me sip my food through a straw. And I hated the pity, the way it made me feel weak and pathetic. One of those detectives stopped by once to update me on the case. They still didn't have any suspects, but they were determined to find the shooter and make him talk. I asked him to keep digging, and he promised he would. But the way he sighed before he left told me everything I needed to know. The shooter might have been an amateur, but he'd gotten the basics right. So I had to accept the chances of finding him were pretty much slim to none. The shooting turned out to be just as psychologically damaging as it was physically damaging, and I was plagued by nightmares for months afterwards. I'd hear gunshots echoing in my dreams, feel the glass shattering and that taste of blood in my mouth. I'd sit upright with my heart racing and try to yell out, only to feel pain shoot through my jaw. During the calmer daylight hours, I'd replay the attack in my head, wondering who exactly wanted me dead. The CFO's smug face kept surfacing, but I knew that he couldn't have been working alone. And that's about the time the paranoia started creeping in. I'd stare out the window in my hospital room, half expecting to see a sniper on the roof opposite me. The nurses noticed my jumpiness and upped my sedatives, but that really didn't help. Not really. And after just shy of 2 months in that hospital, I was finally discharged. I thought it had helped to get back to the familiar, but I was wrong. I didn't feel comfortable in my apartment. I felt too exposed and too vulnerable. I couldn't stay, not with the shooter still out there. I packed, sold my office lease, and moved to a new town before setting up again under a fake name. Now, I take infidelity cases. Small, safe, and simple jobs where the risk levels are minimal. I watch from a distance, using cameras and caution, avoiding anything that smells like corporate greed. I still got the scars. My jaw clicks when I eat, and I got a crooked smile and some missing teeth that the implants couldn't fully fix. Speech came back slowly, and I manage now, but those who knew me before say they can hear the difference. The nightmares still visit me sometimes, just less and less frequently, and I've learned to live with them. No one ever worked out who that shooter was or who hired him. So about 6 or 7 months in, I got a call from the detectives to say that they were being transferred from the case. I wasn't mad. I knew they'd tried their best, and I'd already kind of resigned myself to never seeing justice for what had been done to me. But it still stung knowing whoever shot me was free, and in all likelihood, they'd probably try to kill again. In terms of who paid them, the CFO is my best guess. But the truth is, I'll never know. The company rolls on, and I'm just a guy who got too close. But I survived. And that's enough for me. I have always been fascinated with detective stories. The idea of solving mysteries and uncovering secrets was thrilling to me, and so after I graduated college with a degree in criminal justice, I immediately started working towards earning my license. I found a firm that had coached me through the application process while giving me some training, and then once I was fully insured, my first real job came sooner than I expected. A woman hired our firm to follow her husband because she thought that he was cheating on her, and since it was little more than a basic tailing job, my boss gave the case to me. I was excited to get started, but deep down, I was very nervous too. It was my first real case, and I really didn't want to mess it up. But the first few days, I followed that husband without incident. I kept my distance, blending into the background as best I could as I figured out his routine. I trailed him in my beat-up car and on foot, depending on where he went, jotting down notes in a little pad that I carried. Nothing he did seemed suspicious yet, but I figured it was just a matter of time. On the first day, I parked a block away from his office and watched him through a windshield as he arrived. Then during lunch, I sat across the street from the sandwich shop that he walked to, sipping coffee while keeping an eye on him through the window. That evening, when he went home, I called it a day, feeling just a little frustrated with the complete lack of progress. The second day was essentially the same as well. I followed him to the sandwich place, and then after work, I tailed him from a few cars back, careful to not get too close. And by the third day, I felt almost comfortable, and I followed him to a bar after work, slipping inside and taking a seat at the opposite end of the counter. I ordered a soda and kept him in the corner of my eyes. He laughed with his buddies over beers. He didn't meet any women or act sneaky, but I stayed patient. I knew investigations like this took time, and I wanted to do the right thing by my boss as well as our client. But everything changed on the fourth day. The husband went to the bar after work, but around 11 p.m., instead of calling a cab, he wandered outside and started walking downtown. I remember following him on foot, keeping a block between us, thinking, this is way outside his regular pattern, and he's got a few beers in the tank. This is it. I got him. We moved through the busy street together, and then turned into a quieter residential area with old brick buildings and narrow side streets. I kept on his tail, then watched as he suddenly turned a sharp corner. Not wanting to let him slip away, I sped up a little, but when I reached the corner, he was gone. The street in front of me was lined up with parked cars and closed storefronts, but no people. I slowed down, scanning every doorway and shadow in the hopes of spotting him, and my gut told me that he couldn't have gone far, so I kept going. After maybe 50 yards or so, I stopped at the mouth of a dark alleyway on my left-hand side. It was narrow, barely wide enough for two people to pass, and the dim streetlights didn't reach far inside. I took a few steps down it, straining my eyes against that darkness when a hand shot out and grabbed me by the arm. Before I could pull back, my shoulder hit the brick wall as I was shoved against it. I tried to fight, but then I saw the knife and froze. It was dark, and it all happened so fast that I didn't realize who it was, but when I did, my blood ran cold. It wasn't just some street thug looking to rob me. It was him. That husband. He leaned in until his face was just inches from mine. I could smell the booze on his breath and see the anger in his eyes. He kept the knife's tip digging into my shirt, just enough to let me feel the sharp point, and he didn't say anything at first. Just glared at me, letting the silence stretch out until my knees felt weak. He then leaned in just a little closer, and in a low voice, told me he'd cut me open and bleed me like a pig if I didn't tell him who I was and why I'd been following him. As the knife twitched against my stomach and I imagined the pain of it slicing through me, I'd never been so scared in my whole life. I tried to think fast and keep calm, but it was impossible. I decided to lie, hoping I could talk my way out of it, saying I was just walking home and I had no idea what he's talking about. But he didn't believe a word. And without warning, he pushed the knife forward just a little, and I felt that blade bite into my stomach. Not deep, but enough to slice the skin. I felt a hot, searing pain flare up, and I remember clutching at the wall behind me as I begged him to stop. I looked down to see blood starting to come through my shirt, and the sight of it made my head start to spin, but the husband barely seemed to blink. And I couldn't lie anymore, not with that knife ready to cut me open. And so I confessed everything in a rush, and my voice was cracking as I spilled all the beans. I told him I was a private investigator, hired by his wife because she thought he was cheating. My whole body shook as I spoke, and I waited for him to plunge that knife in deeper. But he didn't. Instead, he just laughed as he admitted it. He was cheating, just like she suspected, but he didn't care if she knew. She'd never leave him because she knew exactly what had happened if she did. He'd track her down, he'd find her, and he'd kill her. The way he said it so calmly and certain was one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen, even after all these years. Then, to my confusion, the husband looked at me with a sort of glint in his eye and started congratulating me. He said I'd done a great job in ensuring his wife would get the crap beaten out of her that night, and every night after, until he felt she'd paid for wasting her money on me. The sarcasm in his voice cut as deep as that knife did, and I pictured her at home having placed all of her faith in me, blissfully unaware of what I'd just set into motion, and the guilt hit me like a ton of bricks. I guess the husband was satisfied with the look that came over my face because he stepped back and put the knife away, but his threats weren't over. He warned me that if he ever caught me following him again, he'd do worse than just cut me. And then he turned and walked off into the darkness, leaving me shaken and breathless against the wall. I staggered out of that alley, my hand pressed against the shallow cut in my stomach. My legs could barely hold me up as I made my way home, and the husband's words were looping in my head the whole way. I didn't go to the hospital. The cut wasn't bad enough to need stitches, and I was too ashamed to let anyone see what had happened. I'd failed my first job, got myself caught like an amateur, and I'd put my client in danger in the process. The thought of facing a doctor, or just about anyone for that matter, made me feel sick with shame. And for a week, I barely left my apartment. The cut healed slowly, and as cliche as it sounds, the real damage was inside. I couldn't sleep without seeing the husband's face or the knife flashing in front of me. The nightmares had me waking up sweating with that laugh ringing in my ears. I thought about what he'd done to his wife, and that guilt ate at me. I'd taken her case to help her, but instead, I'd made everything worse. I thought about calling her, warning her or something, but what could I say? I had already done enough harm. I avoided mirrors because I didn't want to see the stupid coward staring back at me. I lost my appetite, jumped at every loud noise, and I even considered quitting. I could just pack up and find some safe, boring job where no one held a knife to my gut. But something stopped me. I'd wanted this career for too long to give up after one mistake, no matter how bad that mistake was. When I finally dragged myself back to work, I braced myself for the worst. I figured my boss would chew me out for screwing up so badly on the first job, but he didn't. Instead, he called me into his office and just asked if I was okay. And his voice was gentle, not angry, and that surprised me. I told him what happened, how I'd been caught, cut, and threatened. He listened, nodding like he'd heard stories like mine before, and then told me bad things sometimes happen on jobs like that. He said it wasn't my fault that the husband was a monster, and he wouldn't think less of me if I decided to walk away. And for a moment, I considered leaving the danger and shame behind, but ultimately I shook my head. I couldn't quit, not yet. That night in the alley had shaken me to my core, but it also taught me something I'd never forget. Messing up could cost more than just my pride. It could hurt people who depended on me. I went back to work with that lesson burned into me. And that fear didn't vanish overnight, and neither did the guilt, but over time, I was able to push it all to the back of my mind. I took on small jobs at first, tracking down missing debtors and whatnot, and I started carrying a pocket knife. Not to use, but feel safer. And just in case you're wondering, in California, you need to carry $1 million in liability insurance if providing armed services. Over time, I got better, more careful, and more confident. But the memory of that first job never left me, though. It was a warning I carried through every job, pushing me to be smarter, tougher, and ready for anything. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and there are super fun live streams on Sundays and Wednesday nights. If you got a story, be sure to submit them over at my email at letsreadsubmissions@gmail.com, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks for members of the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember.
Hey, yo, bro, pass the Spurs.